Welcome back to this Tuesday's Across the Movie Aisle, presented by Bulwark Plus. I'm your host, Sonny Bunch, culture editor of The Bulwark. I'm joined, as always, by the award-winning Alyssa Rosenberg of The Washington Post, Peter Suderman of Reason Magazine. Alyssa, Peter, how are you today?
I'm swell.
I'm so happy to be talking about movies with friends.
First up in controversies and non-troversies, we are going to be talking about stuff that happens in Alien Romulus, which we're going to be reviewing a little bit later on, but we're going to be talking about some stuff that happens in the movie in Cons and Nons right now. So I'm going to put the spoiler warning here up front, right at the beginning of the show. If you're worried about spoilers for Alien Romulus, go watch the movie, come back, listen to this episode. If you've already seen it or don't really care about that sort of thing, listen on. We're going to be talking about some casting stuff. You know, there's casting surprises in this movie. And that's, I just don't want to get yelled at. That's my big spoiler thing. I don't actually care that much about spoilers, but I know there are folks out there who do. So I don't want to get yelled at. I'm giving you a chance to turn it off now. So hopefully you've done that. Because again, we're going to be discussing a casting choice in this section of the show, or really a quote casting unquote choice in this show. It's scare quotes. Those are scare quotes, folks, because the choice made in this film was something like the opposite of casting. We're going to discuss the plot mechanics in a bit in the next segment, but for now, all you need to know is that the protagonists of this film, Alien Romulus, they wind up on a space station that's owned by the evil corporation Weyland-Yutani, which is searching for aliens from the Alien series, as everybody knows. And on this space station, they find a synthetic, or an android, whatever you want to call it. The synthetic has been half destroyed, but when they turn it on, they do a systems check, and then it comes around and turns around to talk to them, and oh my gosh, it's Ash from the original film, or at least it's the same model of synthetic as Ash from the original film. Here he's a droid named Rook, and he is played once again by Ian Holm. Now, this happened in the movie theater as I was watching it, and I thought to myself, oh, wow, I thought Ian Holm had died a few years back. I guess I was wrong. They've, you know, de-aged him some, but it's good to see him. Nice little effect. It's a little bit weird looking, but, you know, we're still working on this de-aging thing, right? Turns out, I was right the first time. It nagged me all the way through. I was pretty sure he was dead. And sure enough, when the movie ended, I pulled up Wikipedia. He died in 2020. Filming on Alien Covenant did not begin until 2023, meaning that there's no way Holm approved of this appearance, or at least of this script, of this specific thing that they were doing. Now, director Fede Alvarez says he discussed it with Ridley Scott, who, of course, directed the original film and is an executive producer on this one, directed two of the prequels, Prometheus and Alien Covenant. He loved the idea of bringing Holm back and grafting his face onto an animatronic with a British actor on hand to do some face acting in order to give the whole thing a simulation of the divine spark of humanity. Alvarez says Holmes's widow was thrilled by the idea, claiming that he thought Hollywood had kind of abandoned him following the Hobbit films. Generative AI was used to make Rook sound more like Holm, and voila, we got some movie magic. On the one hand, there are all the standard worries about AI. It's bad. Artistic consent clearly doesn't exist here. And artistic stagnation, which is evident throughout this whole movie. Again, we can discuss that more later. But there's also just honestly something very funny about the deployment of the technology here, right? Like, after all, this is a series in which an evil corporation exploits workers for its own profit and pleasure to the greatest extent that it can. Indeed, one of the plot points in Alien Romulus is that Weyland-Yutani is trying to create a worker that can cheat death, that can survive working harsh conditions, deke out a little extra profit for the corporation. So what does Disney Fox do? It just says, hey, yeah, we'll do the Weyland-Yutani thing. We're going to offer up a vision of a worker who cannot die, who serves the company in perpetuity, in death and beyond. It's all legal. It's all in the contract. Everybody's getting their full shares. So it's all moral, right, Peter?
Yeah, I mean, I think you make a pretty good case for both Disney and Weyland-Yutani here. In my most Sonny Bunch opinion, whatever other issues I may have with this movie, I do think it makes even more so than the previous films clear that Weyland-Yutani is actually a force for good in this universe. They are trying to figure out, trying to use science to extend human life, make people more productive, happier, obviously, because when you can work more and produce more, you're a happier person. And also, like, that grows GDP and makes the economy better for everybody. And that you can't share the wealth if you don't create the wealth. And a human who can survive the ravages of space is a human who is better off than one who's like, you know, needs sunlight and is food and might die in a vacuum, right? I'm sort of kidding, but I'm not entirely kidding. I think the issue with the Ian Holm thing is there's two ways to look at it here. The use of his likeness, I would say, is totally justified to me on several grounds, not just the sort of legal grounds, the fact that there was permission from everybody who, you know, is still alive, who, you know, might have had some sort of artistic or personal interest in it, his widow, Ridley Scott, et cetera. It's justified to me on a sort of property rights grounds, right? In the sense that, like, if you are, imagine you own a business, you own a pizza shop, right? And you, this business you grow throughout your life, it's how you make your money. And eventually you pass away, you leave that business to your heirs, to your wife or your kids or whatever. They can sell that pizza shop if they want. They can continue to make pizzas at that pizza shop under your name. You call it Sonny's Pizza, right? Like, and Ian Holm's business was his face. Was his likeness, was the, like, that was the property that he developed and made money off of, and there, and he left it, right? Like, he's gone, so he has no, you know, sort of permission, right? It's not him anymore. So his widow has that as a kind of property that can be left. But then the other way to think about this is as a matter of actors and acting. And so we've all seen the Harry Potter films, and we all know that in the middle of shooting the Harry Potter films, the actor who initially played Dumbledore died and was replaced by a different actor. And in some ways, that is what is happening here, is that, like, when the new Dumbledore came on the scene, he was playing Dumbledore, that tried to make him look exactly the same. They didn't have computer technology to do it. They had old, you know, costumes and makeup, right? But, like, it was the idea was, let's make him look like the character that you have seen on screen before. We can't do that with the old actor because the old actor is simply not around anymore. And that is what they wanted to do for narrative purposes here, is have somebody play someone who looked like a character we'd seen in a previous version, but that the original actor had sadly passed away. And so they brought in somebody else to do it. And instead of having that person put on a wig and a, you know, a magic hat and a robe, they had that person put on a digital version of that other person's face again, that was, you know, that, with the permission of absolutely everybody who is still alive here. And actors do that sort of thing. They play a role that somebody else has played before. And I don't see that this is hugely different, except for the fact that there was a different technology, a different kind of makeup, or a different kind of Hollywood effect in play here. So just as sort of a matter of, like, is this okay? I think it's not just okay. It seems totally fine. Like, it seems like the sort of thing that you can analogize to things that have happened for a very long time before, but people are scared of it because it's a new technology. I would say, I don't know that it adds very much to the movie. And the best criticism here is the one that the great film critic for New York Magazine, Bill Jabiri, put on Twitter earlier today, which is, you know, the resurrecting dead actors thing is sort of a side issue. The problem is that it just doesn't add very much to the film. It's just a sort of, like so much in this movie, it's just a kind of, hey, you remember that? Didn't you like the first Alien and the fact that there was a robot in it? And it's just, it's a pretty empty sort of fan service kind of Easter egg, rather than something that actually adds depth to the narrative or the story or the lore of the franchise. And maybe you can say, well, they shouldn't have done that because it's such an empty gesture. But that's true of kind of the whole movie. The whole movie is just a series of reminders of the great things you loved about the previous Alien films.
I forget. Are you... I feel like we've discussed this before. I can't remember. Are you in favor of, like, copyright books being in copyright for, you know, 70 years past people's deaths and that sort of thing?
I think copyright should exist, but I think it should not exist for as long as it does.
Okay. So it's interesting you mentioned recasting, because I do think recasting is, you know, we talk about recasting or emergency situations, right? Like when the actress who played Livia Soprano died in the midst of filming season two, and they had to use a little bit of digital trickery and editing tricks to kind of make her seem that, like, she was still there when she had.
Or the Paul Walker situation with the Fast and the Furious Walker films situation. Where about a third of what you see in that film was either stuff taken from a separate movie or his brother, and then some digital trickery.
Right.
There.
And I think, look, I think there's an argument to be made for emergencies, for, you know, when somebody dies and you have to kind of finish doing a thing in the midst of it. But this is not that, right? This was planned. This was, they just were like, well, let's just resurrect him from the dead. A closer example is what they did with Grand Moff Tarkin, with Peter Cushing in Rogue One, where they resurrected. And that was one of those things where at the time I was like, oh, this is kind of neat, weird and creepy, but also kind of neat. And I got to say, I object to this not just because there is no ability for these artists who they're offering more than just their face and their voice. I mean, it's a choice. If we believe in the idea of actors as artists, the idea just taking away their agency and saying, we're going to make you say these things with your dead ghost corpse here on digitally inserted into the screen is different. That's different.
Without getting too existential about it, one could say that it wasn't the filmmakers or the studio that took away his agency. It was the fact that he died.
Okay. I mean, is there any limit to the things you could put him in? Could you have him doing a hardcore sex scene with a Bishop? Get some synthetic on synthetic action in the next sequel? Would that be okay? We're getting off point here. The larger problem, Alyssa, I think, is that there is the real issue here is just the absolute creative stagnation here, which is like the only reason for this guy to be on screen at all is for the audience to clap like seals and say, we recognize him and this is so much fun and I like seeing things I recognize on the
right.
screen.
And, you know, we've talked a lot on this podcast about the extent to which franchises have eaten Hollywood. And that stagnation is only going to increase if we not only see the sort of same ideas and same IP and same story points, but we see the same faces for eternity, right? And part of what is really fun about watching the movies over time is seeing someone new emerge, right? Like, I really like having gone from not knowing who Mike Face was 5 years ago to being like, you know what? If that guy is in something, I want to see it. I have really enjoyed watching like Glenn Powell step up and with some of the same sort of cocky charisma, but also the ability to like be, you know, do some different things in sort of maybe in the mold of Tom Cruise someday. I really like seeing Zendaya emerge as a star. And, you know, I like seeing different people make different choices, and I like seeing the arcs of their careers and what they do over time, and then seeing new people come up and reinterpret old archetypes. And the idea that we might get stuck not just with a sort of, you know, franchisization of our movie stories, but, you know, with a certain class of actors frozen forever is weird and unpleasant to me. As a matter of aesthetics, totally separate from any question of sort of morality or copyright law, right? Like, I like Clark Gable a lot. I think Buster Keaton is one of the most important actors of all time, but I like that we live in a movie-going culture that can evolve from Buster Keaton to Tom Cruise, you know, bungee jumping off things. I like seeing actors and the craft build on each other, and I want to be able to see people age. I want them to be able to have a sort of definitive end to their work. I don't want to see just, you know, the same faces projected on ultra large screens for eternity. I want that to grow and change over time. And I don't want to be 80 and watching movies where Glenn Powell looks exactly the same. Who knows what they're doing to Tom Cruise to make him look like that? But like, even Tom Cruise someday will presumably age and become mortal.
No, that can never happen.
No, he looks older already. He looks just over these last 5 or 10 years here. He's aging
exactly.
Gracefully.
So it's like, I want the movies to sort of be forced to change a little bit. And one of the ways that happens is through human mortality and human aging and the sort of very things that keep us alive. And so, you know, I have a lot of concerns about the sort of, I do think like the use of someone's face and their voice just feels sort of categorically different to me in some ways than just sort of the use of someone's work or creation, you know, within copyright. But more than that, I want the movies to be a living thing. And that will be less possible if, you know, we sort of keep reanimating the corpses of the dead.
And along the same lines here, drilling down on one point here, you know, this is a movie that is filled with fresh faces, right? This is a movie that, you know, Kaylee Spaney has been around. She's done some good work over the last couple of years here.
But,
you know, she shot this before Priscilla came out. She shot this before Civil War came out. You know, she shot this probably right around the time, little after Devs, right? Which was where I think a lot of us first saw her. And she's really good. She's really good in this. David Johnson is another actor who's in this, who gives a really interesting and good performance. He plays the android Andy, the synthetic Andy. And we'll talk about that a little bit more in the next segment. But again, there's a bunch of other people in this who aren't as good, frankly, who are all kind of interchangeable to me, who I didn't really make a huge difference. But the role of Ash, that kind of synthetic role, it's a role that A, could have been played by somebody who's still alive. You could have put Lance Henriksen in that role, have Bishop instead of Rook, or David from Prometheus, right? Or in Alien Covenant. You could have had somebody who is actually alive and can make a decision to come do this to play that role. Or you cast somebody entirely different. Cast a new old actor. How about that? That would be a crazy thing, right? An older actor, a veteran of stage. And instead, it's just you have this total artistic stagnation that is so... Oh, God, it's so representative of everything that is just absolutely kind of wrong with the state of franchise big budget filmmaking, or even medium budget as this movie is filmmaking. I watch it and I like my everything about me goes ick. It really crystallized a lot of reasons why I did not like this movie, just thinking about the ethical and artistic implications of what was done here.
You're supposed to go ick at the chest bursting, not at the use of innovative technology to bring back the likeness of an old character.
And yet, here we are. Here we are. All right. So what do we think? Is it a controversy or a non-troversy that Disney, Fede Alvarez, and Ridley Scott reanimated the corpse of a beloved actor to give people a slight thrill at the sight of somebody they remember from previous movies? Alyssa?
A little controversial.
Peter?
It's a non-troversy.
Definitely a controversy. This is a million times more controversial than anything that was in Late Night with the Devil. Horror film fans were like, oh, this is so horrible. You can't make posters with generative AI. And here they are just bringing people back from the dead. Yeah, sure. That's fine. We should do that. Okay. Make sure to swing by Bulwark Plus on Friday for a look at the Alien series writ large. So many entries, some of them very good. Others of them less so. And now on to the main event. Alien Romulus. It's set between the events of Alien, in which Ellen Ripley and the crew of the Nostromo encounter the black-skinned, acid-for-blood xenomorph on the surface of planet LV-426, and then Aliens, in which Ripley returns to LV-426 with a platoon of space marines to save a colony that has disappeared. So Alien Romulus is set on, it's in between those movies, it's set on a different planet entirely. It's a mining planet. It's been taken over by Weyland-Yutani, and it's there's some alien stuff happening, believe it or not. Rain, played by Kaylee Spaney, was born onto this planet where the sun literally never shines. She and her synthetic brother/protector/companion, Andy, who's played by David Johnson, are alone on this miserable rock. Rain's parents having died from their work in the mines long ago. Andy is kind of twitchy. He has basically android brain damage, and he has been programmed with a full panoply of dad jokes and only one directive: to do what is best for Rain. If what's best for Rain is for him to stay on this hell planet while she earns enough money to get off of it and travel to some better world that doesn't allow synthetics, so be it. He'll stay back for her benefit. Unfortunately for Rain, she's not going anywhere anytime soon. Despite having done the required amount of work, when she asks for her transit papers, her request is denied, and her quota is arbitrarily increased. increased. I want to talk about that in a minute because it annoyed me on a storytelling level. We'll get to that. So she and a team of street urchins right out of Dickens decide to head into orbit, hijack a derelict Weyland-Yutani space station, and steal the cryopods inside that they need to get their ship to the promised land. Turns out that Romulus is a research space station. You'll never guess what they've been researching. It's aliens. They've been looking at aliens, specifically the alien from the first Alien, which they pulled out of space and brought back to life and then reverse engineered to create the goo from Prometheus and Alien Covenant, which the aforementioned Rook, the guy who is played by the ghosts of Ian Holm, believes can be used to make some sort of super worker that can survive the deadly work on less hospitable planets in the galaxy. Yada, yada, yada. Can Rain and her crew survive this horror show? You'll never guess. Lots of them die. So the first thing you need to know about this movie is that it's a nonstop smorgasbord of member berries, right? There are just references to every film in this series. Some of them are small, right? Like there's the sour tone at the end of the 20th Century Fox fanfare that calls to mind a similar musical beat at the beginning of Alien 3, which is not a great movie. Like the aforementioned goo and the resurrection of Ian Holm or the addition of pulse rifles late in the film turns the whole thing into a replay of the hive scenes from Aliens. This is an original film, kind of, really. It's more of a blended remnant of all the other films that were thrown into one of those little, you know, food processors and kind of pulsed over and over again until what came out was
an alien smoothie.
Sort of a alien-like substance that you know and remember. The second thing you need to understand about this is that it's still, even my complaints aside, it's a relatively effective sci-fi horror thriller sort of thing. Alvarez, who directed the great Don't Breathe, has a great eye for this sort of thing. He understands how to build tension. Also, this film weirdly feels almost like a remake of Don't Breathe, just set in space. It's about a bunch of kids breaking into someplace they shouldn't be before realizing that they have made an enormous mistake and things are going to get much worse for them in ways they did not entirely expect. The acting here is a mixed bag. This movie is a little bit like Muppet Babies Aliens. You got a bunch of generic Cockney scamps running around rather than like real adult characters like the truckers from Alien or the Marines from Aliens or the prisoners from Alien 3 or the space outlaws from Alien Resurrection. Another bad movie, but at least one that had some kind of interesting characters and stuff. Even the prequels have characters that feel like real grown adults. It helps that they're played by actors like Idris Elba or Danny McBride. They have like personalities. They exist in a world where you can kind of understand them as separate beings. Not so much here. I don't care about any of these kids. I don't care about any. There's nothing interesting or worthwhile about them. And there are these moments, like there's this, even Kaylee Spaney, who I like a lot in Civil War, and I thought she was pretty good in Priscilla. There's this moment in this movie where they do a big hero shot of her and the doors open and the camera angle's kind of low and the lighting, you know, and the smoke. And it's designed to be like, look at this badass. And I just thought to myself, is she 12? And then like very shortly after that, is she above 5 feet tall? These are the ideas that are going through my head when this happens. It's probably not what you want in a movie of this sort. Again, loved her in Civil War Priscilla. I don't think she works here. Bad miscasting. I would like to say a positive word about David Johnson, who is great as Andy playing the character first as, again, kind of a brain damaged android, but good natured, and then is more fluid and smarter, but then like kind of more evil because his program is being rewritten by Weyland-Yutani. Interesting. I thought he was doing really fascinating stuff. I'm excited to see what he does next. I don't know, guys. This movie's mostly kind of competent, but also just really, really annoying. And it also just undermines its own premise. It just undermines its whole premise about the wickedness of corporations exploiting workers by literally being made by a wicked corporation exploiting a worker beyond death, from beyond the grave. Weird. Alyssa, what did you make of Alien Romulus?
These movies are really not for me, just like on a lot of levels. Like they're gross in a way that I have trouble dealing with. And like I had pretty vivid nightmares after this movie. They particularly deal in sort of like both rape horror, like they're explicitly sort of rape fan, you know, horror movies. and pregnancy horror in a way that I really struggle with. I texted both of you after I'd seen this and was like, sort of jokingly, like, oh, a movie that turns pregnancy and delivery into something that takes place in like 90 minutes, actually kind of utopian fantasy. I mean, yes, except when your kid like then absorbs you in some way. I don't know. Which is to say, I think like I realize that I'm sounding sort of more brain dead than usual in talking about this movie. In part because it's just like, it's so not for me. And it's sort of an interesting example of a movie where I kind of wonder if the metaphors about sexual assault and the sort of horrorization of pregnancy are more effective in communicating to people who haven't had those experiences or who like don't have any sort of touch points with those experiences than they are to kind of like live through them, or than they are to watch if you have experienced sort of those things in an adjacent way. Like they just, I wonder if they are more effective in like being like, hey, here is a really, really intense metaphor about like what it's like to be pregnant if you haven't been pregnant, and just like they're almost too much if you're like, yes, I have been pregnant. Like, I've been through labor and delivery. Like, I think for me, they're an interesting example of, you know, something that really doesn't work for me for reasons that have nothing to do with the movie or even the concept itself. They're almost sort of too effective for me. And I'm almost more curious how both of you respond to both the very explicit, and like this was explicit from the first Alien, right? Like this is a rape fantasy. These are sort of horror visions of pregnancy and motherhood. Like, I'm almost more curious about how you guys respond to those two elements of the movie than I am able to be articulate about my own feelings in response to them. Does that make any sense?
Well, I feel like the term rape fantasy is
not fantasy. Right. Like, they're like a sort of fantastical vision of rape. Like, I mean, my understanding is like in the development of the original, of the Alien itself, like there was a sort of explicit discussion about how the sort of like the face hugger stuff, the chest bursters were supposed to be like a vision of like a horror vision of like homosexual rape that was supposed to, you know, be particularly horrifying.
All right, Peter, what do you make of all of that heavy stuff about, you know, sexual violence and Alien and horror?
So Alyssa is at least correct that there was an explicit idea to make the alien design in the first film quite phallic, right? And this was understood as there was a sort of I don't know if I've never heard that it was designed to make men afraid or sort of feel terrorized by homosexual rape. Instead, what I've always the commentary that I've read or sort of the academic interpretations that I've read have always focused on it as a sort of, as a sort of feminist gender kind of commentary with, you know, the one sensible woman on the ship turning out to be the hero, right? And you don't know that she's going to be the hero. It's actually, the film is structured in the first hour or so like it's going to be Tom Skerritt, who is the captain of the ship, who is going to end up being the kind of protagonist. This is back when the final girl archetype was not nearly as established as it is now. Alien was part of what helped establish it. But like that stuff has always been built into the movies. I guess watching the new one, because we'll talk about the rest of the franchise on the bonus episode, watching the new one, I just thought, looking at that, at the pregnancy sequence in the third act and how that is developed, it's just like so much in this movie, it is just there because it's been present in the franchise before. And there wasn't another reason for it. It's just like, well, the Alien films have often dealt with these sort of genderized, you know, issues of gender and pregnancy and body horror, and so we're gonna have a pregnant woman in this, and then the baby, sorry, spoilers, more spoilers, folks, then the baby is gonna get infected with the alien mutant goo and turn out to be basically a version of the final monster from the fourth Alien film, Alien Resurrection. That scene plays a very explicit homage. I mean, which is kind of a weird choice, given that I really like Alien Resurrection, but I would not describe it as like an incredibly popular film that sort of lingers in people's imaginations. The two Alien films that people generally love are the first two. And the fact that like they decided to end on basically just a rehash of the fourth film, but with a little bit of Ridley Scott's Prometheus goo magic like attached to it. It's just an odd choice. It didn't signify, oh, we have something to say about this. It didn't in any way sort of mean anything except what everything in this film means, which is, hey, you loved the Alien films. Weren't they pretty cool? And I do. I love the Alien films. They are pretty cool. I am moderately obsessed with at least the first three of them. I'm like sort of like the one of my, you know, sort of most opinions that I sort of trot out every now and then that people disagree with is that Alien 3 is a great movie. I think that the second one is one of the, you know, the first and the second one are films that I've seen many, many, many times. And the second is one of my all time favorite films. But this just sort of everything in this, from the body horror and the pregnancy to the elevator sequence at the bottom of the ship to, you know, the literal quoting of "get away from her, you bitch," the kind of culminative line from Aliens. Everything about it just seemed like, I mean, Sonny called them member berries, but it's just, you liked it before, we'll put it in the blender and serve it up to you as an Alien smoothie. You'll get all of it again. And that's it. And it's well done on a sort of moment to moment and beat to beat basis. And there's, I think, one somewhat innovative and pretty good action sequence here in the third act, the bit with the gravity and the, where you have the gravity is going on and off in the space station. And they use that to have the alien acid blood not splatter through the walls and keep let in the vacuum. And it's a clever bit that is well executed. And there's a bunch of bits in this movie that are pretty well executed, but she just doesn't have any idea other than we've all seen the Alien movies a ton of times, and man, they rule. They do. I agree with that. They rule. But you gotta have something else. And part of the reason why those movies rule is they all felt like they were trying to do something interesting and new and original that the previous films hadn't done before. This film feels like it is exclusively trying to do things that the films in this series and this series alone had done before.
Well, and that's, I want to highlight that one cool sequence, the gravity sequence. And there's another kind of cool sequence where they're trying to silently go through a hallway. Yep. And avoid a bunch of the facehuggers. You know, we learn that the facehuggers sense heat, so they raise the temperature real hot. Everyone's the same. It's the same temperature as the body in the room. It's 98.6 degrees, and they got to get through it silently to keep the. All right, both those sequences, the strongest, I don't know, visual referent really is not the Alien series, not the movies. They feel like video games. Those are almost explicitly video game sequences. Like,
it's not just that they are almost explicitly video game sequences, is that this movie has a bunch of references that are quite explicit to the Aliens, to various Aliens video games that have come out over the last decade or so. Right. And in fact, if you read the interviews with Fede Alvarez, like, he's like, we've just pulled a bunch of stuff there's from those games and tried to build them into the films.
Yeah, I am like, again, you can make video game style sequences and they can work, but the whole thing feels, I don't know, cheap. And
yeah,
and
I definitely was like,
good.
So I don't know if I assume, Alyssa, that you have not played the Dead Space games. Sonny, I don't know if you have, but those games are highly indebted to Alien, but trying to do, or Alien and Aliens, but trying to do a different thing. And this movie kind of weirdly felt indebted to the Dead Space games in the way that they have you exploring a, have the characters exploring a space station that has monsters, you know, alien monsters in it. And then, you know, some gravity complications, weapon upgrades, all of this stuff, right? And then it's like becomes this kind of physical puzzle of getting through the level, the maze, right? And then killing the boss at the end. Very, very video game like in structure. But I do think pretty well executed, pretty effective on its own terms, just as a little bit of action filmmaking. But it's just a couple of sequence ideas does not a good alien movie make, even if I do have to respect the craft and the technique on display here.
Well, the problem is none of these characters are memorable in any way.
Oh my God. Only Andy. Andy's the only character that's worth a thing here. I mean, I was thinking about this in the context of certainly Aliens, which just has this incredible supporting cast of people who instantly become, you know, define themselves and who they are and their relationship to the rest of the cast, mostly the Marines. But also the first Alien, which has a little bit of, like, I can see what they were going for here. Like the first Alien, the characters actually don't define themselves super quickly. This sort of grows on you over the course of the 2 hours of the film, right? You learn who these people are by the decisions they make, the way they react under pressure, under quite, you know, extreme and difficult circumstances. And here, you know, you almost don't even learn anything about these characters. You certainly don't learn anything that you care about, but it's like, who are these people? What are they doing here? They're just snide teenagers who are there because that's what Fede Alvarez had in his first movie.
Well, there's a very specifically political thing here where you're supposed to identify with them because they are the oppressed underclass. Like it's making a class consciousness argument. And if you don't inherently buy into that, and frankly, I don't, you're not going to sympathize with these characters because they're not real people. They're not even archetypes. They're just,
they're meat.
Scamps.
Yeah. They're just like, they're meat that needs to be moved around and then killed in sort of a maximally violent way. Sunny, you had sort of made the point that you were frustrated by the plot device early in the movie where Rain, God, I was struggling to even remember her name. I was like,
yes.
Ripley Jr. Has her quota just sort of artificially increased by Will and Yutani. And I wondered for both of you sort of what you make of the movie's treatment of corporate power. Because, I mean, arguably you can say a company that's like comfortable, like recreating the black goo and trying to preserve, you know, versions of the alien so it can make a new sort of race of workers. It's like definitely evil enough to do something that like just sort of double people's quotas to keep them on the planet. But I feel like the movie's treatment of sort of the evil corporation is very, very thin.
I want to talk about this in the bonus episode, actually, because I have a whole theory of this series that basically the short version as a little teaser is that the series shifted from a movie being about Ripley to a movie being about the corporation at the same time that Ripley / Sigourney Weaver kind of aged out of the role, but also because the corporation in question needed to exploit its assets.
Yeah.
And it's like, it's actually the story of the films is actually really kind of interesting if you think about it in parallel with the rise of Weyland Yutani as the almost really the protagonist of the series. We can talk a little bit more about that. But the reason
not the protagonist, but the connecting thread for sure.
Almost explicitly the protagonist. But we can talk about that a little more. But specifically to the point, the reason I was annoyed by the arbitrary raising of the quota is because one of the things that was always really interesting about the movie, in particularly in Alien and Aliens, and a little bit less so in Alien 3 and not really at all in Alien Resurrection, is the one of the things that was fascinating about those movies is that the characters were all trapped by legalese, right? Like, so in the original Alien, remember, the truckers didn't want to go down to the planet. Like, they were like, why are we doing this? This is not, this doesn't involve us getting more money. And they had to, they were explained, it was explained to them that if they did not go down there, they would forfeit their shares, that they would forfeit their profit participation in the film. And that's what they were doing. The whole Paul Reiser character in Aliens is trying to create, he's basically like a, he's a junior executive at a 1980s, you know, car company that's trying to create a whole new line of cars. So what if the cars killed, you know, 10% of the passengers who ride in them? You know, there's a lot of profit there to be made in cheap cars. So like it's a fascinating, it's again, and this movie just by kind of negating that legalese by just being like, actually, we're just going to, you know, arbitrarily raise your the amount of work you got. You're going to be here for another 5 years because we own you on this prison planet that we're running, apparently. Like, I'm sorry, it was ridiculous. It's not even that it's ridiculous, Alyssa, because as you mentioned, like, this is a comically evil organization just in general. But it violates the spirit of what made those first films work. It's one of these things where it takes something from the first movies and just uses it, like uses the skin suit of it without understanding what actually made the thing interesting and made it work.
The version of Weyland-Yutani in this movie does not resemble a corporation. It is a totalitarian government. And in fact, the longer we go in this franchise without seeing any other corporation or government entity at all, there's no other controlling authority in the alien universe at all. Every single time you encounter an authority institution, it's Weyland-Yutani, and that's not a corporation.
It's a corporate state, right? I mean, it's sort of more, it's more like the equivalent of the East India Company.
Yeah, something like that. I mean, in the fourth one, they actually deal with the military, not Weyland-Yutani, which is kind of interesting. But the military and the science, yeah, it's the military-industrial complex. You know, it's bad, folks. But anyway, we can talk about this more in the bonus episode, which we should get to taping here in a few minutes.
You should subscribe to this podcast to the Bulwark so that you can hear the bonus episode, because
if you don't
great.
Subscribe to Bulwark Plus, you're not going to get this bonus episode, which is going to be a good one, because I sat through all of these movies, folks. Well, Peter can yell at me about that. All right, so what do we think? Thumbs up or thumbs down on Alien Romulus? Alyssa,
I feel like I need to absent myself from this. I don't, it's just
so much not your jam. Yeah. You cannot even, okay. Yes. That's fair. Peter,
I have very mixed feelings about this movie, but ultimately I think I have to give it a thumbs down, just because, like, I want to give everything about this movie a thumbs up in terms of like the filmmaking, but the film itself doesn't work.
Yes, that's exactly right. Thumbs down for the exact reasons that Peter said. The film itself on a beat-to-beat moment is fine, even entertaining sometimes, but the whole concept of the thing is annoying and bad. All right, that is it for today's show. Many thanks to our producer, Sebastian Hughes, without whom this program would sound much worse. Make sure to swing by Bulwark Plus on Friday for our bonus episode. Tell your friends. Strong recommendation from a friend is basically the only way to grow podcast audiences. If you don't grow, we'll die. If you did not love today's episode, please complain to me on Twitter, @SunnyMunch. I'll convince you that this is, in fact, the best show in your podcast feed. See you guys on Friday.